Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see a Jew.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Opus, an exploration of legendary records and their ongoing legacy. Not just their history, but how this music continues to evolve. We're opening the vault on classic records upon re-release, delving into their inner workings and their lasting impact. Maybe you're a longtime fan and wants to go a little deeper. Maybe you're a first-time listener and you're curious to hear more. Either way, you're in the right place. Find us at Consequence of Sound or wherever you tune in to podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With, an interview series presented by WFPK, Independent Louisville, at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Hey, take a second before we get started to hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now. We put out multiple interviews every single week, and you can keep up on Spotify, on YouTube, Acast, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts from. Make sure to hit the subscribe button. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Courtney Taylor, Taylor of the Dandy Warhols. Not only do they have a brand new record called Why You So Crazy, but it comes during their 25th anniversary. In fact, they're going to be taking the whole thing out on the road for a 25th anniversary tour. We'll head back to Portland in 1994 to see what was going on when the birth of the band happened. And then, of course, we'll get into the ins and outs of that brand new record. Talk about the first two singles, Forever and Be All Right, a little connection to Bowie's Modern Love, and how, as the record's been called, a surrealist vision of an alternate reality. It's Kyle Meredith with the Dandy Warhols.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, let's start with the idea of the 25th anniversary tour. I don't know if it was just chance that it lined up with a new album or you guys did it like this, but I don't know, man, that's an amazing accomplishment, you know? Most bands don't make it, you know, 5 years, 25, let alone. How much of that's been on your mind right now?
Yeah, well, I get asked about it constantly, so it's omnipresent truth that yes, those days were 25 years ago, and so I'm doing a lot of like, oh my god, that was 20 years ago.
I mean, I do that. I like doing that in interviews. I do a lot of interviews where I celebrate the big round numbers, and we kind of get into them anyway because. I don't know, because I'm a music nerd and I want to know all about that stuff anyway, but it's a nice time to time travel safely, I suppose. But,
yeah, we did a lot of that one in New York, and I happen to be reading a book about New York in the 80s right now, where it was very bleak, and it still was in the end of the 90s. It was a really bleak place, so things like that are really fun to, like, God, I haven't thought about that in a long time. The reality of all the different eras that we've been through and the ups and the downs and who we've met. Yeah, it's crazy, crazy.
What, you know, to look into 94 for a second at least, you know, Portland 1994, like, it's just out of eyesight for maybe what was happening down the road in Seattle. Like, what comes to mind when you think of Portland in 1994?
Well, armpit is the first thing that comes to mind, and it really was, and it was super artsy and fiercely still hippie in its politic. So I was in, you know, I was in high school in the 80s, and I had friends that were in bands and were squatting downtown and still making it out over the hill to the first kind of suburb out, Cedar Hills, to go to high school. And they were squatters. It was, I mean, it was so soft here. You could live on $100 a month. You could rent a room in someone's dilapidated old Victorian for probably 50 a month. And then, you know, you just have $50 to buy rice and beans and vegetables. And I mean, I knew people that were just living like that. It was amazing, you know, and there was a lot of just weird styled people, self-styled people, you know.
I mean, that's what I thought. It was the era of Let's Get Weird. Like, for an artist, that door was wide open.
Yeah, there were no politics involved in what style weirdo you were. You were just a weirdo, you know, and hopefully you had a real cool look, you know, and talked real cool and knew about artsy things and Man Ray or whatever, you know, you knew who, you know, you were into Scorsese films, you know, and you were just a fringer artsy person. And there were just a ton of them here, like a ton for the small size of the town, you know, less than 500,000, to have such an intense fringer art scene kind of dominate the whole public. I mean, it was, you know, it was what certain things would be front page local news, you know, certain art events or, you know, building the skate park and having bands play it, you know, indie bands on indie labels. It was front page news or, you know, anything happening. And so it was really a special place, and it made for us, you know, we were fully formed already, who we were and what we are. And, you know, we didn't really do a lot of growing in the public eye. We were pretty firmly ourselves in our tweaky thing. I just read a review of our record where one thing funny that he said is that after 20 of our new record, you know, it's getting pretty great reviews. So, but after 25 years, they still seem to have no inkling of, well, or no reason to bother sounding like anybody but themselves or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And I just thought, God, is that, you know, that's really great. Is that really what we've just been doing the whole time? I guess so. I mean, I try to avoid current trends, but I never really try to, we don't really try to, you know, have a sound or anything sound like ourselves or anything like that, but
I mean, I would say that, you know, there is a dandy sound, and there's a lot of colors on that palette for what you've done with it, but
right. There is the.
But yeah, I'll end our journey in 94 right here when I was thinking, like, you know, what you're saying with all of the, you know, unique styles and everything that kind of came through the door and matched with, you know, what I remember a lot about the time was, you know, the sarcasm and cynicism of that era. You know, a lot of folks finally saw that, you know, how they were being marketed to, and you know, that made its way into, like, that's how I see the Dandy Warhols beginning.
Grunge, pop grunge.
Yeah. That's how I start seeing the, you know, how the Dandy Warhols kind of come in, because you do have that, you know, the weird styles and the psychedelic and garage kind of flashbacks in the music. But you also, because of your lyrics, you know, you really painted that pretty clearly a lot of times, you know, that I see what you're doing to me, you know, it's.
Oh, right. Yeah. You know, actually, I never thought about that. That is a good point, is that I think, yeah, those records, they are very of their time in the lyrical approach and content. They really describe the era, I think, pretty well, and the mentality of the era, whereas they don't really, you know, they don't sound like Stone Temple Pilots or Chili Peppers or anything. They don't have a, you know, a trendy sound of they're not idiosyncratic of their eras, but yeah, they sure do. The lyrical content. God, I never really think about my lyrical content as a what it is picture. I know that people think it's all about cynicism or have reduced it to that, but obviously not. You know, there's a lot of, well, I mean, there's just a lot of self crucifixion, I suppose, and harvesting of regrets.
As we move on to the new record, Why You So Crazy, does the album, itself, does this new one find any moments to reference those years gone? And I'll ask in the context that some artists, I think it can always feel like you're always in competition with your past.
No, I never really do. We never had a moment of our past that produced that kind of effect where, you know, because when Bohemian Like You, once that had already peaked and had been as huge as it was time for a new sound. Everybody was doing guitar rock 3 years after that thing came out. It was, you know, it went from nobody doing vintage guitar rock to all these amazing bands, were getting huge, the White Stripes and the Strokes and Jed and the Vines and great recording artists and great artists. And, so it had become, commercialized, and then all sorts of other bands start doing it and having one kind of one-hit wondery sorts of bands doing it, or bands put together around one song to have that kind of sound. And it got, it gets commercialized. So it was time to move on anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the nature of, I think, my view of music is, just is the sound cool or is it or not? Or does it sound like a bunch of other people's music that you're just imitating their overall sound, which to me, it makes it, I can't open my heart to that, just the sound itself. Before anyone opens their mouth and starts singing or relating stories or lyrics or perspective through language, the sound itself has to seem so breathtaking and fresh and beautiful and powerful to me that I will open my heart and listen to this person once they do open their mouth anyway.
Well, I hear a little bit of that on, on Forever. That was the first song that we heard from Why You So Crazy. And I talk about you all painting with some different colors. Maybe it's the, because once you tie music to a visual, like the music video, and I think, because there is a ghostly quality to what's going on musically in that song right there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last times you were here in Louisville, you and I were talking about how with the birth of Spotify, it revealed songs that you previously didn't know were as popular with your fans. And I think the song was Sleep, specifically, that we were talking about.
Right.
For me, Forever sort of has that lineage now. Like, oh, you guys like that? Oh, we can do that.
Right. That, yeah. What is Sleep, or what does Forever, what on earth does that sound like? I keep trying to, because it started out with this, Dr. Dre string things. And then once it got the haunted, Pink Martini piano, it became sort of like Ghost Town, the Specials Ghost Town a little bit. And then the vocals are, I feel like they're just straight up Damon Albarn, Gorillaz era, but, snottier delivery and texture and just the sonic texture of them. We really worked the sound. So that, I love that one.
Yeah. The
video turned out great. And, it looks really cool. And I love that it's just an absurd, series of pretentious metaphors, but it just looks so cool. And I got the Pander Brothers to kind of, I just give them the, walk them through the story, how I want it to look and feel. And then they just take it and go with it. They're these comic book illustrators that did early, they're kind of pioneers in the 90s modern comic book, The Dark Knight, Batman The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. They did a lot of that. And so they become really cool filmmakers. So, yeah, it was great to get them for that video.
You brought up that little piano, and I was kind of wondering, between the first two singles and also talking about Be All Right, it seems like that little piano takes a bit of a starring role on this record, at least out of the gates, in a way that I don't know if you've used that before, but I guess I've never noticed it in the same way before.
Yeah, I didn't really even think about it until Be All Right came out. And actually, the video, I was watching that and getting that 3D, that 360 thing to work. And then I went, oh, right. The two piano songs came out first. So it actually just looks like that's our kind of our hook, is there's like, it's a big piano record. But I think that's the only piano on the record. Well, it also ends with Ondine, which is a solo piano masterpiece from 1918 that Hunter Nowak played, who has, I think he has a special on like CBS or something, or did maybe recently. And we were just, smoking weed and drinking champagne and hanging out and having Thomas Lauderdale play. And Hunter is his boyfriend, and he sat down and started just laying out this amazing piece of music that is this Ravel piece, 1918, called Ondine. So that ends, it's a 6-minute surrealist piece, which was in 1918, I think, you know, they had been doing, you know, surrealism in general was really, everyone was gung-ho. So you had super talents like Ravel doing it. Because they didn't have, you know, delays or echo chambers or anything like that back then. So if they wanted to produce psychedelic, trippy, opiated-sounding music, they had to do it with notes and textures and blurring notes together and swirling things around. And so, yeah, Ondine is an absolute, probably the greatest piano masterpiece I know of. So that we do have three piano pieces there.
You know, what you're talking about, there's a line in the press release where you, I think it was you anyway, who, you know, somebody at least calls this record a surrealist visions of an alternate reality. And, you know, and when I look more at Be All Right, too, because first off, to say the words Be All Right and then have a line that references 1,000 points of light in it, like, it's hard not to look at, you know, some possible political undertones or overtones, I suppose, however you look at that right there.
Yes. Yeah, it did from the first formation of it, the first inception of it, to the final done, written lyrics rehammered over. Yeah, it definitely went that direction. You can't help but want to put out some kind of a positive message, right?
You've taken it back, though. I mean, you took that and you did the flip. You made the you made the big small. You made it personal. I mean, you know, 1,000 points of light. Suddenly, you know, I don't remember, was that Reagan or Bush? I do forget about that one. But you've taken it back to this romantic spot, as I can hear it on this song, and that's always a great trick.
Yeah, that's Fathead. Fathead wrote that. Yeah, he came up with that whole blast of lyrics in this one go. I think he recorded it on his laptop on a 14-hour airplane trip on GarageBand, and then, yeah, we took that one from there. So that piano is played in GarageBand on his laptop.
Oh, wow.
You get a lot of... Yep, you know, fly a lot, and you can write a lot of song, a lot of time for songwriting.
How does the Church of Bowie's Modern Love make it into the record?
I have there's a moment where David did this and one of those heroes, or I don't remember, one of that era, maybe kind of the Station to Station era, where he just lets out, but it's one of his hits, and he just lets out this roar, this operatic roar. And so, yeah, in the church, to the church, in our song, To the Church, I just had this perfect moment to do that, and it's hysterical, and it's in there, and it's really beautiful. I mean, it's really... It feels completely necessary at that moment to like crescendo this trippy, like, maelstrom of sound that's been going on for all. It's kind of, you know, that's a song where you push how long you can just kind of send trippy stuff into the speakers, you know, like, and so that one's kind of, you know, pushing a pop structure, you know, to your patience, maybe. But yeah, and that just a crescendo moment there with I channeled old David Bowie. God, it's great. I love this record so much. I just listen to it all the time. I just put my fat headphones on and I just crank it up in bong major, and it just gives, it's like everything, salvation, you know, open-mindedness, redemption, love, loss. It's just everything's in there for me. It's sonically just like the best work we've ever done. It's just such a freaky and, you know, emotionally and powerful experience, but it's tweaky and clattery and rich, and yeah, it's something else, man.
I mean, there's not been a Dandy Warhol's record that I've ever disliked, ever. You know, I love what you all do every single time, and this one's been an exciting first listen.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for, you know, give me the ins and outs of it all. Good luck with the ankle.
yeah, I gotta get that thing together. I was walking down a dark driveway on New Year's Eve, and that, lo, there's a hole in the driveway, and so I went ahead and twisted my ankle pretty badly in it. So, I gotta get. Apparently, it takes 3 weeks to heal a sprained ankle, and in 3 weeks I get on a plane to go tour Europe for 8-9 days or so.
Perfect timing.
I better get on with x-rays, therapies, and whatever else, and, I don't know, acupuncture, whatever I got to do right now, like literally get in the car and do it.
All right, Courtney. Well, thanks again for the talk, and hopefully I'll catch one of these shows out there, man.
Yeah, cool. All right. Thanks, Kyle, man.
Take care.
See you later.
That's Courtney Taylor Taylor talking about the new album from the Dandy Warhols, Why You So Crazy. Now, for you hardcore Dandy fans, I'm actually going to include two older interviews that I've had with Courtney. One was pretty recent, actually. It just came out in 2017. Between albums, they had released a brand new single. And then a much earlier interview from 2012, when he'd put out a graphic novel called One Model Nation, that ended up having a companion album to go along with it as well. So that interview's from 2012. I'll also include that a little bit later on. But first, the 2017 interview, as I was chasing him down from a European tour. It's Kyle Meredith with part two of the Dandy Warhols.
What we're really talking about is this one brand new song, Thick Girls Knock Me Out, which just sort of appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, we're always recording, and we're always working because we've always owned our own studio. So, how we arrive at records isn't like a traditional, let's go in the studio and make a record. It's I think we have enough for a record, you guys. Should we just finish this song, that song, and that song and make, okay, great. That feels like a record. Great. And so this was just a song. And since we're touring Europe, we just thought we'd put it out in Europe. And the way the world is so interwebberly connected, you can't really just put something out in Europe. You just put it out, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, the song itself, I'm not one for pushing an artist back to their earlier catalog, but it actually seems like it's one of the most reminiscent songs of some of your earlier material that I can remember lately.
I hear that every day. Well, it sounds like your old stuff.
And I apologize for that because I'm not one to push an artist that way.
I love our old stuff. I mean, I like all our stuff. I listen to my band every day. I probably listen to more Dandies than all other music put together, really. But that's why we do it, I suppose. Yeah. So I have the perfect stoner experience. You know, just I smoke pot every day, so I smoke pot and. I like Zeppelin and I like the All Laws and I like lots of stuff, but I listen to more of us, because it is my perfect stoner trip. So this is just a goofy, giant, redhead, Irish, obnoxious chick 10 years ago, punching me in the shoulder, being wasted, slam dancing to the Irish band that was, just being the worst person. I don't even remember whose friend she was. We were in an Irish bar, and I think we were really. I mean, we weren't even in Ireland. We were like maybe in Spain, I think maybe. And it's just one of those stories that just lingers, and then one day it just is handy because it just falls into place with some music, and then you have a song, and it's clever and kind of funny and. If you just fit some more words in there, like it's done, Yeah. So that's kind of how that happened. And I'm so tired of just talking about Donald Duck, just everyone just only talking about him,
Right.
So it did seem like a relief at least to have something funny, just something that isn't about something really smart and going to really work out all the problems or angry or bitching or just hopeless or any of that. It just seemed like what was necessary right now.
Well, to close up on the song though, I did have that other question about how the Beatles fit in with the story. I mean, you of course reference Paul in the lyrics, but you've got Ringo and his birth name there stuck in the title. That parenthetical title.
Right. Well, I always karaoke to It Don't Come Easy.
It's a great
song.
And
so it's serious as a heart attack. I mean, it's really amazing. That is one of the best songs. Try it next time you're out karaoke.
All right.
Just go for it. You'll find that it's easy. You don't have to know it by heart. It's just real easy and it rips. I mean, it plays itself, man. It's really fun to sing karaoke. Yeah, and I just thought that somebody's got to point out that Paul McCartney put out a record called Kisses on the Bottom. What on earth? That was the only reason that was, I just, is because somebody needed to point that out. That went almost completely unnoticed. Just me and a few of my friends just went, what the? And so I've been just dying to put that out in the public.
Right.
The chick was the giant bruiser was pogoing around and bumping into people and to an Irish, probably to them covering the Proclaimers or something. But I had to rhyme slam with the jam, so I put in the city. It's got a nice, ring. They certainly weren't covering In the City by the Jam,
right?
At that moment, 10 years ago, and I wouldn't even remember what they were playing, but yeah. So it's just fitting the rhymes together. Got the Jam in there. Got Paul McCartney and Ringo. I've also got the Plugs in there.
I missed that.
Red Eye Number 9 is by the Plugs. But that was just so I could get Sparky, because electricians, when you're for builders, they're called Sparky. And I was just putting something together with electricity in case anyone would catch the Plugs reference. Yeah. And I had to rhyme it with Starkey.
I mean, when we started this off, you almost kind of wrote the song off like it's a goofy little song, but there's a lot going on in that. Like, that's not just something that had to have fallen out of you. I mean, there's some
right. It's intelligent a lot of goofy. Thought. Yeah. It's like all good stupid things. They're smarter than they seem. As long as nobody pours over it as a piece of literature, as a precious piece of intellectual work, I think it'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, buddy, I'll let you get on the bus there, but I appreciate you making this time for us. And I really love this song. We're going to be playing it a lot, and I can't wait to hear what else comes from you guys. So
thanks.
All right. It was good talking to you.
Yeah, Kyle, man. I'm glad we finally did it.
Yep, we finally did it. We'll do it on the next single, too.
Okay, cool. Sounds good.
All right, take care.
Cool, you too.
Bye. Courtney Taylor from the Dandy Warhols. Again, that's from a 2017 interview. As I mentioned, there was a much earlier one that I recorded in 2012. It was the first time I'd ever spoken with Courtney, who had just put out a graphic novel a few years before that called One Model Nation. And then in 2012, he released a companion album to go along with it. So I'm going to include that interview here for you as well. It's Kyle Meredith with Courtney Taylor.
So your latest project, One Model Nation, you've basically given life to this fictional band through a backstory and several levels of media. Mm-hmm. How did it come apart? What's the story on this whole thing?
Oh, I guess it just sort of started out as a stoner idea, hey, I know, what we should do. And then, and that was Donovan and I had come up with the main idea of this, German band that was involved on the same level, on the same kinds of things that in the late 90s hip-hop movies, drugs, guns, cops, mm-hmm. music. Mm-hmm. So, somehow we had discovered very quickly in our conversation that we were both, as young teens, really into the German kind of late 70s, early 80s art scene, the Nina Hagen and, Bowie and Iggy being there making records, and all the things that Sprockets thought was funny, mm-hmm. we didn't think was funny. We thought it was really cool. So, between Noi and Kraftwerk and, just all sorts of things, Nitzer Ebb, and there's all sorts of stuff thrown in there. Gary Newman, mm-hmm. came up with the the idea, and then it just seemed like fun, and it never stopped being fun. And then after a while, Donovan then had a kid, he and his wife had a kid, and then so he kind of dropped out, and I sent the script to a friend of mine who's a very famous filmmaker and pretty much a perfect filmmaker of about any style. And he has not called me back since, and that was like 10 years ago.
All right.
So that's how bad that was. So I just kind of tore it down, took it on as my own sort of jet lag, wide awake, popping up wide awake at 3 in the morning, you know, kind of thing to do, and got, you know, just made it very serious. I also kind of made a hyperspatial timeline and geography for Germany. So it's not really either Germany, neither east nor west, and it's just sort of whatever I needed of both or either. And personally, Star Wars and, you know, Lord of the Rings, Dr. Zhivago, these are my favorite movies. They're just epic. So I needed to have some travel in there and some... so, you know, they go to London, they end up in Bavaria, they, or the main guy does, and there's Amsterdam in there, and so there's some travel and some movement. I also condensed the, you know, 10 or 12 years of German politic, 70s, late 60s history into, you know, 3 months.
Right.
And then I have the band disappear. You know, the big picture, this is, I invented a German art noise band that disappeared in 1978. And that was a, you know, a good idea, so that if this thing caught on, which for some reason it is, I didn't think there'd be that much interest in a fictional German art noise band that disappeared 30 years ago or whatever. But, I won't have to, it cannot become another entire job, because the band is gone. They can't go on tour.
Right.
So, great. you know, and I, certainly if the thing got huge and, you know, if a movie comes out and it gets a, you know, big sort of, you know, funsy people that like these kind of brain-teasy sorts of things end up becoming real fans, so that we can sell out Madison Square Garden as our first show, then I'll go on tour, I think.
Sure. And there you go. I mean, it's all in there. You know, it's not the first time, though, that, I mean, by far, I guess, that, you know, there hasn't been the fictional band. And I was trying to think of some of those, or even, you know, kind of band changes the world type of movies. Gorillaz, the latest, and that did take off. I mean, I think Damon Albarn was saying
what,
that.
What happened? The Gorillaz have a movie?
Well, not a movie. I'm just saying that was supposed to be one single record.
Right. And yeah, now it's a tour. Whatever. That's like... just a comic thing, right? They don't have stories or anything, right? They're just
a little bios,
band,
right?
That then they had someone draw a comic sort of what is that stuff? Is there a name for that style? Little monsters and things?
I'm not sure.
yeah. It's a really cool thing. And do that tour?
They do tour, but it's just at first I think it was holographic images or just big screens, but now it's just Damon Albarn and whoever else is guesting on the record playing the songs live.
Do they show the creatures? Or?
Yeah, I think they're all built into, you know, screens behind them.
Right.
Yeah,
that just seems like a kind of, clearly they could get something going a lot quicker than I could, and I think that's probably why our project is actually developed and has depth and has... because we, you know, we couldn't get anything going.
Right.
I was thick into the Dandy Warhols thing, and anyone I described this project to thought it was cute, and I got a little pat on the head and a little slap on the butt, and go have fun. I know, get back there and Dandy Warhol it up. See you in Spain or whatever, you know. The Gorillaz thing, I don't know. It's a music project that they sort of had half an idea
right.
for the other part of it. But they really should be making movies and things. I guess they don't care. Is the bottom line is that if they did care to develop it, it would. I mean, they could have the best the world has to offer for writers and, you know.
But I guess even Kiss themselves had the fictional backstory. So on the far other end of the spectrum of something like that.
Right, and they did make a movie that. Phantom of the Park,
is that right? I assume they made one somewhere in my mind. I was told they made one, but I couldn't have went that deep on it.
So. I was probably 10 years old or 8 years old. I don't know. I was at the right age to not care that it totally blew that movie. I was, wow, a Kiss movie. Cool.
We've all fell victim. You had mentioned, you know, so you picked this post-World War II era Germany, which plenty has been written about. To develop this, did you just know all the politics and the history at this point, or did you have to do extra research?
Donovan actually just got into it. I only cared really about the music and the art scene. Mm-hmm. That was my thing. And then Donovan started unearthing all this stuff about the Baader-Meinhof gang, and you know, I mean, if plenty has been written about it, I sure have never seen any of it, or had never seen any of it until Donovan started finding. I had never heard of the Baader-Meinhof gang. I didn't know anything about post-war politics in Germany, you know, except that they were a destitute nation, and I don't know what. And then something, you know, now they're not. But yeah, talk about phenomenally interesting. They were a completely destitute and bankrupt nation after the war, utterly destroyed, and within 25 years they became the richest nation on earth.
Are they?
They were by 1972, 73.
No, I didn't know that.
They decided to not, more or less, and I don't know how accurate any of this stuff is, because frankly I don't care, but they had decided to not import things. Mm-hmm. They just, as a nation, they just, you know, we're going to make things and we're going to sell them to the rest of the world.
Right.
And it's not going to take long and we're going to be a major superpower again. And so they did, and it worked. Wouldn't it be fun if America did that? No. That would be so amazingly cool. Get all those factories that are sitting abandoned across the Midwest and the Rust Belt and just put them to work and let's make stuff and sell it instead of stripping our resources, our natural resources. We just suck them out of the ground and then sell them to the Chinese.
Right.
And then they make them into something, and then we buy them back from the Chinese. And we'll pay for shipping. You can just drop ship that stuff direct. We'll pay for it. It's just, it's ridiculous. Sitting on this book is, you know, and making it and kind of looking at how this other thing went down over there, was interesting, and it also kind of gives me a perspective of you know, my mind being blown at how just fat and lazy America is, and you know, not much foresight or about, you know, what where we're going and everything. And there's a lot of you know, Democrat mouthing, blogging, kind of, you know, super lefties, you know, screaming, you know, the end is near, but it's not getting anything done, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. All they're doing is hyping each other up and, you know, and a lot of correcting each other on blog sites. But it's an interesting thing that it happened, and it sure makes for an amazing setting for an art project, you know.
Sure. And even can it change? Does it take an entire cultural meme at this point to make anything change?
Yeah, I'm just surprised that after, you know, we crushed Germany, how often in history has it happened that somebody goes in, absolutely crushes a nation, and then just leaves them alone?
Yeah.
Obviously, the Russians couldn't do it. They, you know, they kind of, well, we're gonna just stay here. No, you're not. We're just gonna stay here. No, you're not. Well, okay, we're just gonna stay here. Oh, okay, you can have there. Build a wall, East Berlin. There you go.
Sure, and that's it.
Russia, part of Russia. Yeah, that was. It was pretty amazing that anybody left that country, Germany, alone. We actually beat the hell out of them, and then, you know, rubbed their noses in their little dog do, and then we left.
Yeah, as opposed to now, which we, you know, supposedly win a war, I guess, but then just stay there for another 10 or 15 years.
Oh, God, we'd be in there strip mining and, you know, pulling out nickel and oil and, I mean, you name it, we'd have them bent to the nosy grindstone for us.
Right.
At this point, we're so desperate for, you know, well, I guess, you know, when your government is actually a series of oil companies, what do you... Yeah, war is a little different now.
That's true.
It's
very, very true. Well, steering us back on path, I guess.
Yeah, get me going. get me started. And have fun editing.
Are you kidding? Most of this will go up on the web as the unedited. That's the fun. This is the fun stuff. The other stuff you've talked about 1,000 times by this point. So.
I sure have. It's really hard to keep talking about it because, like, really, do I even sound like I'm in, like I'm thrilled or you know about these words in this order anymore? I don't know.
You're holding it together well. You are.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And one of the last things about One Model Nation, was it hard to create music then that was supposed to be from the past?
No, not absolutely not at all. You know, we knew in our heads kind of what the job description was. Mm-hmm. We don't want it to sound like it's from the 70s. We wanted it to sound like it could be, or it might be, or questionably would be. The thing is to make it as fresh as it would have sounded then.
Right.
'Cause if you listen to Kraftwerk or Can... Now, it doesn't sound that fresh. It sounds like really good, you know, electro. Mm-hmm. And it does, there are telltale signs of its age. So, if, you know, I would come downstairs and, you know, we did it in my basement, made that entire record in my basement studio in Washington. And I'd come downstairs and listen to what was going on and, you know, letting the guys do, you know, pretty much all the work, because I, you know, I own a studio and I'm in it all the time. So it was a lot more fun for them. Mm-hmm. So I would come down, and if it wasn't sounding old enough or crusty enough, I would just, you know, line up the bicycle frame and the iron chairs and the pots and pans, and I would start clanging on things, you know, and then, okay, there, now it sounds old.
So the Dandies, they hit, you know, you guys had success early on. But it looks like as you've progressed in your own career, maybe it's less important to have that be-all hit that plays everywhere. And especially now with One Model Nation, it seems like it's even more about the art than about... I mean, it was just this off-the-cuff project.
Well, you can't sit down and write a hit. I mean, certainly the Dandy Warhols was never about... Well, we wouldn't know how to write a hit. We didn't know what the hell we're doing.
Right.
The Dandy Warhols' prime directive was to make music that we wish somebody else was making, but they're not.
Right.
We just filled in gaps, and that's why we never had any hits. We did not have one hit in America in 12 years or whatever. We were on Capitol Records, major money, the whole bit. We did not have one hit. Every record we put out flopped and then got big a year and a half or 2 years later. So, you know, I don't know how any... I don't know why that the Dandies are successful. We're still a band. We still have a career. You know, we still have influence and juice in this world. We tour, we put out records. I guess we just have our own sound, and if you like it, there is no one else that you can go to get it. So once we have people kind of hooked on our, you know, psychically, you know, kind of unique and emotionally, you know, pretty clear and potent trip, there, you know, you're kind of in for life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how that worked out. And I definitely had a few hits, like in Norway or Greece or Australia, mm-hmm. And then a couple big ones in the UK. Those also were failures when they were released, laughed at and patted on the head and a little slap on the bottom and off you go.
Yeah.
That's cute.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody listens to that kind of music. And then a year and a half later, whoa, re-release, woo, huge hit. And so, you know, hits are accidental in my world.
Right.
I have no control over it. And One Model Nation right now is, what, like one of our songs, Transmission or East Berlin, is number 3 on the specialty radio chart in America. Number 3 in the specialty radio, like what? I have no idea how this world works, none. But I do know how studios work, and I know how I like music to feel, and that's kind of the way you should work. You know how you want it to feel, and then how you get there is really is nobody's business at all. You just start going, and if it doesn't feel like, and you keep working and carving and pulling this out and add this instead, and you know, layer this and move that out to the side, and oh, turn that part up, and then you know, take a break, come back, and go, God, that feels exactly like I want it. That feels great. And that's generally how I have always made music, because how else do you know when it's done?
Well, now that you've done this this multimedia project with One Model Nation, is it changing the way that you're making the next Dandies record?
No, I don't think so. Maybe I'm just tired of electronic stuff. The Dandies record that's going to come out in a few months is we just finished, like, last week, final mastering, done. And it, I don't think it has, I don't think it has any keyboards on it.
Okay.
It is all guitar. It's a rock record. And then kind of slides somewhere into sort of shoegazy, gothicness, maybe. I'm being told it's our darkest record a lot, and I like that.
You always have to hear it from other people.
Yeah, that's why I never ask bands when, you know, someone at a party or someone, someone goes, oh, you should hear his band, it's amazing. You know, oh, really? Dude, what's your band called? You know, Sum 41 or whatever. No,
right.
But, you know, like, oh, we're called, you know, Dinosaur Senior or whatever. Like, I never ask them what they sound like. I always ask them, what do people tell you you sound like? Because otherwise you'll get Sum 41 going, well, we're kind of like The Clash, you know, but do you remember Sum 41? Does anybody remember Sum 41?
I remember them. Yes, I do.
Yeah, they were fun. I don't really listen to modern music. I listen to Renaissance music. That's kind of in my house what I listen to. I also have a medieval-style house, so it really is quite perfect to have.
I don't think that's what I would have imagined at all, but...
Yeah.
The way you talk about music and everything, it keeps bringing me around to, because you've just released more info on the new record and everything, called This Machine. You've been through the machine. And the machine of
different
music.
Different kinds of machines.
Sure, but the machine of music, you know, for whatever it's been in the last 30 years, apparently there's always been a machine of music for hundreds and hundreds of years. I might guess that your title has nothing to do with that, though.
Oh, when the title came up, it was that. It was the machine of the four people in the Dandy Warhols. It was the machine of you know, the nature of nature. And, yeah, it just, that phrase just really nailed it in so many ways. So I can't even remember what, what the first connection from the phrase to my or our lives was.
Are you guys happy to still be going indie at this point?
Well, we did a really, really bad job of having our own record label last time. And not only was it no fun, but we sucked at it.
Yeah.
So,
I've heard that from other people. They say the same thing. It's like, it's a good idea when you try it. It's always a good idea in theory, I guess.
But, yeah.
In practice, it's a bit harder.
Yeah, it turns out we like to make music. We don't like to make emails.
Yeah.
We don't love that nearly as much as we like to make cool guitar parts, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, the Dandies, we're going to try the kind of a halfway in between. We've got a small label in New York that's part of... this group called Sony Red Music, and
I know them.
They're the ones who put out Phoenix whatever a year or two ago, and had some great success with that. They're a coalition of independent labels.
They're good people. I know them personally. They're good people.
Oh, great!
Yeah.
God, I'm glad to hear that, because I really like them.
Yeah.
I just, the most unpretentious, you know, real music loving people. They just are really into it. I think they have very good taste, and at the end of the day, you never know if you're going to have success or not, so you better just have a good time and like the people you work with, and you know, so you can kind of sit around like the last of the Vikings, you know, just going, well, you know, I guess it's not really working out anymore, you know, that was fun, good job you guys, you know. Or, if you have great success, then you get to hang out with these people you like even more until the success does run out. Then you sit around the campfire in your, you know, your broken arm and your bloody nose, and you go, ah, damn it. Well, it was fun for a while, you guys. Good job, Vikings.
Well, Courtney, thanks so much for still liking what you do and continuing to do it.
Yeah, we got that one figured out. We never really tried anything else.
Yeah, well, it's
oh, wait, no. I must amend that.
Okay.
I just wrote a song for Twilight that wanted a submission from the Dandies. So, so I wrote a song that has nothing to do with me or my feelings. And it's interesting. It's a liberating experience.
Hey, my thanks to Courtney Taylor-Taylor of the Dandy Warhols, the new record, Why You So Crazy. And hey, if you haven't already, please do hit that subscribe button. Again, we put up multiple interviews every single week. Would love to keep you up to date on all of those. You can subscribe at YouTube, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts and iTunes and Acast and Podchaser. Really, wherever you're listening to this right now, there's probably a subscribe button in front of you. After that, please do head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern, where you can also find some bonus episodes of this series. Of course, you can stay up to date at consequenceofsound.net. You can find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith, Facebook.com/Kyle Meredith. That does it for this episode. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.